Someone last week published something that said the FDA has been decapitated and eviscerated at the same time. That's a very graphic way of saying it, but basically almost all the leadership that was there is gone. A large part of the workforce that holds the organization together is gone. All this means that if something effective and different isn't done, things are going to grind to a halt because the innards have been taken out and the people with the institutional knowledge have been taken out.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. Our country is a powerhouse in biomedical innovation, contributing nearly 40% of the world's biotech patents. And at the heart of that innovation is the FDA, the often little understood or misunderstood agency that regulates everything from the drugs we are prescribed to the food on the shelves at the grocery store. Like so many other government agencies, the important function of the FDA is being threatened by dramatic cuts over the last 3 months. And there is no one better to help us wade through the implications of these cuts than a man who served as commissioner of the FDA not once, but twice, Dr. Rob Califf. In this episode, Rob and I talk about why the FDA should matter to every American, the potential impact of the cuts, and how we can rebuild a trustworthy health system in an age of disinformation and disruption. So please welcome Dr. Rob Califf to The Other 80. Well, listen, you have such an interesting career that spans all the corners of life for drug development, from academic research at Duke, leading strategy for Verily, and then being the commissioner at FDA twice under both President Obama and Biden. And as someone who spent my time also in and out of government, there are mysteries that only appear once you're inside the doors. And I'm curious what you didn't know about the FDA that became apparent when you began your work there.
Yes, I had had a long career at Duke, and every 5 years I got a new job within the institution, always trying to compare it with what was outside, and just seemed like a great place for me. And then finally, Peggy Hamburg came down and made a visit and told me she was about to retire after 6 years tenure, which is a pretty long stint for an FDA commissioner. There was thought that maybe I should be the next commissioner, but of course the problem is the president has to offer you the job. You can't just announce you're going to be in the job. But I was ready for something different. I came up during the Vietnam War, and my draft number was very high, so I did not serve. And I'd never done government service, so I volunteered and went up as a civil servant, which lasted a year. And it was a great experience when the American people are your customers, and you know that. I mean, as you well know, it's a very inspiring mission that you have. Then things happened, and the president asked me to be commissioner. But I'd say the main thing that you just can't really fathom until you're in the middle of it is the way the executive branch works. You kind of expect from everything you hear that interactions with Congress are going to be difficult, and you're dealing with typically people that are 30 years younger than you with these major decisions where the members of House or Senate don't have time to know everything about everything. But the way the executive branch works is, just as an example, the last year as I was giving the various talks and lectures that commissioners do, I always made it a point of asking, do you know what OIRA is? And I swear, you know, these are like schools of public health and public policy. Almost no one knew what it was. Almost no one. And yet, anything that you want to do, as you well know, that has to do with policy has to get through that lens, which is completely controlled by the White House.
And just for listeners, OIRA is the branch of OMB that manages the regulatory process, which would include regulations, but also some sub-regulatory guidance would also go through that, which is distinct from the budget side of OMB.
It's one of the many reasons why I always bridle a little bit when people say the FDA didn't do this, the FDA didn't do that. Well, more than half the time, the FDA wanted to do it, but couldn't do it because there were other considerations. Now, I want to be clear, this has nothing to do with approval of individual products like a drug or a device. That's historically been kept at the civil service level. Political interference is not allowed. Not that people don't try, but it's not allowed. I'm really talking about policies. Like one that's pertinent today is, what do you do if food dies? It's not as simple as the FDA deciding what the answer is.
Thinking about especially your second term as commissioner when you came back under the Biden administration, and of course, President Biden had really doubled down on the cancer moonshot, and I think wanting things to move quicker and more responsively to come up with new therapies that could have saved his son before he died. And so this was a huge point of passion and commitment for the president. What were the things you committed to do, especially in that second administration, and how far did you get in that progress before you left?
I came in the middle of the pandemic. And so I came into an agency which was doing all of the routine work and dealing with the many issues. You remember the Delta and Omicron waves that left many, many people dead and disabled, with its own, you know, enormous tranche of work under tremendous pressure. And so I would say that agenda of focusing on medical product efficiency really took second seat until we were well into the term, because you just, there was only so much that people could do, and the workforce, as dedicated as it is, you know, you can only work a certain number of hours in the day. But we did some things that were less focused on cancer per se, because the cancer center at FDA, which had come into being during my first administration and really flourished, the cancer community was pretty happy with what it was doing. But we really had issues with rare diseases, where we had this amazing opportunity to treat diseases that were previously completely untreatable, often leading to death in childhood with no other options. So we really had to be creative, and we put together a hub for rare diseases to focus on coordination within the agency, but also coordination with patient groups who are very important here, and working with the industry on the methods. What do you do when there are only 100 people in the world with a disease? You can't do your traditional clinical trials, so you have to develop alternative methods that involve Bayesian statistics and probabilities and things like that. So a lot of effort went into that part of it. I get the impression, although I've not had been in the seat, that in most areas in the U.S., people don't want more regulation. They want less. And that certainly came up as a big issue during the last election and is playing out as we speak. But the regulated industries with FDA live and die based on FDA guidance. They want more guidance, not less. It's very hard to get people to understand that. This is really important. 9 out of 10 drugs which get into human clinical trials don't make it to market. And the reasons for that are, number one, you have an off-target toxicity that you couldn't predict. Number two, you engage the biological target, but the benefits aren't clinical, aren't relevant. It just doesn't have the effect you expected. And number three would be, you can't manufacture it in a reliable way to make it a viable product to distribute to the world, where you have accountability for good manufacturing. And so what that means is, trying to rush drug approval, you'd better do that carefully, because most things don't work. And in fact, if you really just rushed it through, you'd end up causing a lot of harm, much more than the good that would be done.
You mentioned an interesting contrast where in many areas of life, people want less regulation, or think they do anyway. We'll see. In the case of the FDA, it plays such an important role in enabling the innovation ecosystem and the investments. About 40% of patents are filed by U.S. scientists and U.S. companies. I'd just be curious, stepping back even from the FDA to include the NIH and other things, what is the role of the government in enabling and supporting that global leadership role for the U.S. in drug development?
And so first of all, I would emphasize it is a global leadership role, and it's really, it just feels good when you're making the rounds as FDA commissioner that the whole world looks at the U.S. as a source of new technologies, biomedical science, of discovery science, all the things that lead eventually to medical products that improve longevity and functionality and quality of life. But that is an infrastructure, which is a vast infrastructure that includes universities, the NIH and CDC, the many other federal agencies and HHS that deliver services that keep stability in the system. And of course, a regulatory process that helps the industries not go off the rails. And it sort of gets back to, why is it that people want more FDA guidance? And you know, of course, it's just my opinion. But the part of the industry that's developing highly effective products, it's so hard to do that if the standard drops, you'll have a bunch of bad stuff on the market, and it really undercuts the value of the things that actually work. So my position at the pinnacle of biomedical innovation as the FDA commissioner is on the shoulders of all the universities and biotech startups and other federal agencies that are involved.
Before we move on to what's going on currently, which I know everyone sees in the news every day, I want to just pause for a minute and talk about the roles of the FDA well beyond drugs, which include a role in tobacco regulation, food safety. Can you talk a little bit about some of those other functions that we may not think about in terms of the role of the FDA?
I've just been amazed by how often FDA is couched as drugs when devices are a huge part of American society and what the FDA does, and especially now with AI and algorithm-driven devices and all the imaging. It's just an amazing time for that. That is a very big part of what FDA does. But then the F in FDA does stand for food. It's at least 40% of the effort, although it's been very poorly funded by Congress relative to the medical product side. And, you know, the primary missions there are, as written into the law, are what I would call immediate safety. And by that, I mean viruses and bacteria in the food, things that make you sick when you eat the food. But then you've got the much, well, I want to say more important, but equally important and vast arenas of nutrition, where FDA is responsible for food labeling, of chemical safety, the hot topic today, actually. Those areas have been so underfunded. It's been a skeleton crew at FDA working on them, but it's a big deal. Then I'd also mention the Center for Veterinary Medicine, very important and at the forefront of the H5N1 response and responsible for animal drugs and devices, but also animal food. And you want to see worked up Americans have something go wrong with dog food. That was the biggest response in the history of the FDA from the public, was when the dogs were getting renal failure due to contamination of dog food. And then, of course, tobacco was added just in Obama's first term. And this is a huge effort. We're seeing great progress there, but we still got 30 million people using combustible tobacco. And, of course, vaping came into being, sort of started on my first term, really took off during Trump's first term and got out of control. And it's gradually coming under control now. But the question of what control of vaping is a really hot societal topic. And then, you know, I want to mention cosmetics, because there had been work for 25 years to improve cosmetic regulation. You know, I love the quiz, how many cosmetics does the average woman use in America every day? The answer is 12. The average man uses 6.
Wow.
So, you know, you think about deodorant and shampoo and hairspray and all the things that we apply on our skin. And some of this stuff has real health risks, like formaldehyde and hair straightener, predominantly used by people of color. It's a broad array of stuff.
I had no idea. I'm going to go look at my cosmetics with a different eye. I want to go back to something you said about COVID and coming in the second administration that you served in the middle of a pandemic. And I think we're accustomed to thinking about CDC as a public health agency, but maybe not as accustomed to thinking about FDA and even NIH serving in those same roles. Can you just expand a little bit more on what was your role during the pandemic?
It started before I came back with a really major role in Operation Warp Speed. So the development of the vaccine was a huge issue, dealing with the catastrophe we had with PPE, things that people needed that were not being made in the United States, and laboratory testing. How do you diagnose the disease? And there were some issues between FDA and CDC that I think we all agree And I'm not here to lay blame, but the testing rollout was too slow. Then the floodgates were open and a bunch of bad tests got on the market, which gives us some reason to continue to work on trying to get the right balance when things happen where you don't have a test and it's a public health emergency. And then you have the whole array of biologics and antivirals that had to get evaluated first. Most of them didn't work. The ones that did needed to get an emergency use authorization. And of course, in the midst of all this, we had the crisis in public confidence. While all that was being done, the FDA still had to deal with the normal pace of all the other diseases that and products that were being developed. Whole new way of doing clinical trials. What happens, like, you know, I think about the pulmonary hypertension community, people really sick, where we had tremendous new drugs being developed. But these people couldn't come to a clinic because if they got infected at all, they wouldn't make it. So they had to do all kind of virtual clinical trials and had to be creative in how to deal with that.
Well, thank you. Okay, let's speed forward to the present. Can you just lay out some of the changes that have occurred to date around the FDA from this current administration?
Sure. Well, I'm celebrating the end of my third month of civilian life now. You know, the biggest thing that's happened is the massive firings that have happened in waves. You had the first wave, like day one, there was an executive order about DEI, and no one really has all the information about this, but it looked like all the people that had DEI language in their job descriptions were laid off at that point. And then you had a wave of everyone who was a probationary employee. And as you know, in the federal government, that means within 2 years of being hired, you didn't get all your civil service protections until that two-year point. And so they could be fired without cause. And that also includes, by the way, people who got promotions within 2 years. So some of the best people who had done the best jobs also were laid off. And then the third wave, 3,500 people at FDA. And it was done in a brutal fashion. They were told to take their computers home. They would get a notice over the weekend as to whether they still had a job. The notice didn't come. Because everyone is required to report to work, people were coming to work at 5 a.m. They apparently sent the notices at 5:15 a.m., but most people had had their computer access shut off before then. So you had this mass of people showing up to work, many of whom couldn't get into work because their credentials were disabled. So you had one line of people going to work, and in very public view, another line of people who had been fired. I've run academic contracting organizations doing clinical research. I've been on the boards of biotech companies. I've been at big tech. I've been involved in a lot of reductions in force because if you don't have money to pay people, you got to do that. But there's a humane way of doing this. That's not what happened here. It was like they turned a bunch of software engineers loose on human beings with no interface to make it a human experience. Many of these people only got 30 days pay, no benefits afterwards. A lot of them have children in school, many of them debts, because many of these people have PhDs and had racked up some debt before they went into government service. So I spent a lot of my time over the 3 months trying to help people who were just left in the cold by this completely, at least in my view, unnecessary exercise.
You're not in the current administration. You're not a leader in that. But what is your understanding of their intent?
I don't really know, but I can only go by what I've read, which is Project 2025. And the man who's the head of Office of Management and Budget, he literally publicly said his goal was to make it so that civil servants felt sick to their stomachs at the thought of going to work in the morning. I have to say that seems to be the purpose is to destroy the infrastructure. And that was my comment about FDA as we know it. I stand by that comment. It doesn't mean it's not possible to put something back together that could be better. And I think we've all got to try to contribute to that at some point. I'm widely promoting Humpty Dumpty as the analogy here that people should be using. I don't think that Humpty Dumpty has fallen all the way to the floor yet, but I'm relatively sure it's going to happen. And there will be more chaos. But then, I don't know about you, but everybody I know that's been in the federal government can think of a lot of things they wish were different that you just couldn't change. Maybe we can figure out how to do this better.
The human impact of those rapid and seemingly indiscriminate firings, I think, are huge. I'd love to have you talk a little bit about the organizational impact of that. And of course, we don't know yet. But if you are thinking from an organizational hat, knowing the way the FDA works, what kinds of effects are we likely to see over the coming months and years if action is not taken to put Humpty back together again?
Well, of course, I hasten to say I know the FDA the way it used to be. And certainly, someone last week published something that said the FDA has been decapitated and eviscerated at the same time. That's a very graphic way of saying it. But basically, almost all the leadership that was there is gone. A large part of the workforce that holds the organization together is gone. People say, well, the reviewers weren't fired, but the reviewers work in big teams of different people with different expertise. And so you've got the project managers who manage all this, many of them fired. So all this means that if something effective and different isn't done, things are going to grind to a halt. The way the FDA was, I can't imagine it working at all right now, because the innards have been taken out and the people with the institutional knowledge have been taken out.
Has the new commissioner called you?
No. I sent him an email. He responded politely, but said he would get back in touch when it was appropriate. And part of this is understandable. Traditionally, while the incoming commissioner is under confirmation proceedings, there's not communication with the outside. But I think also all the former commissioners, we have a pretty tight group, Republican and Democrat, mm-hmm. nominated, and we talk all the time. So I hope this communication will pick up now.
And if he called and asked your advice, what would you say?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, and I'm not going to give any specific advice. I would just say get to know the workforce. If you're going to make major changes, which obviously are going to be needed, it's going to go a lot better if the workforce is behind you and bought into what's being done. And given what's happened to the morale from everything I'm hearing, that's going to be a tough sell. So you got to work on it. And then the other part is make sure that your decisions are evidence-based. And I hope that the sanctity of the dividing line between political interference and civil service decisions will be kept. And basically, I think a simple way to think about this, policies are political by design, partly for the reason I gave. Many of them require a congressional law or rulemaking, which by design goes through the whole executive branch. That's political. There's no way around it. But decisions about individual products, several times in the history of the FDA has that been interfered with politically. And a big job of the commissioner is to block that interference so the civil servants can do their jobs. Those are the main general things. And I don't want to get specific because, a new commissioner needs to have room to operate.
I was at a conference a couple weeks ago and Dr. Oz was there. And he was talking about the Make America Healthy agenda, the MAHA agenda. And I think for many of us who've been in healthcare for our careers, there's so much of that that's deeply appealing, that we know while we lead the world in innovation, we are falling tragically behind in health and in the length of our lives and in prevention, all those things. I'm just curious for you, with all the perspectives you've had, with all the experience you've had, what would be your Make America Healthy Again agenda?
First of all, let me just say, I bet you didn't know this, by the way. Dr. Oz is a Duke man also. He did his surgical internship at Duke and then went back to New York. And, he was a very good cardiac surgeon. I'm a cardiologist, so, and a very smart guy. But in general, what I'd say is we got the right problem, but the wrong solution set being offered, at least from what I can see right now. It's been a big part of my career to proselytize on the idea that we are the leaders in innovation and new technology development. Among all large high-income countries, we're in last place in application of that technology for health benefit. We have the shortest life expectancy, and as you point out, the shortest healthy life expectancy and a much larger burden of chronic disease. We also have problems that we refuse to even acknowledge. Gun violence. There's a really great study from AAMC, the Association of American Medical Colleges, that points out if you look at the four-year gap between the U.S. and other high-income countries, which is hard to even say, isn't it? We have a four-year shorter life expectancy now. Half of that is gun violence, overdose, and suicide, and alcohol. So those are not going to be solved by some direct medical intervention. They involve other social services and policy approaches. But the biggest thing in the other half is cardiometabolic disease. So this is my specialty. And I'm sorry, but the solution to cardiometabolic disease is not nutraceuticals and more vitamins. It is healthy food and exercise. And so exercise, I think almost everyone agrees on how much and in what circumstances, how do we make it possible for people that live in dangerous neighborhoods, for example, to exercise. You know, people like you and me can go to the club and do our workouts with a trainer, but a lot of people can't. But healthy food is a red hot issue. It should be. I've already mentioned there's nutrition and there are chemicals. Right now, the easiest food to eat in the U.S. for everybody is unhealthy food. We make it really easy to do it and make it really inexpensive. If you want healthy food, you got to pay more here, and you can't get it in a lot of places. But, you know, one that people don't talk about enough, in my view, is generic medicines. If we look at cardiometabolic, you can think of this as like a stew that Americans are living in now that includes too many calories, or so too much weight, too many carbohydrates, so glucose concerns, high blood pressure, use of tobacco, and lipids, your cholesterol levels. All of that except the weight now is controllable with generic medicines that are very inexpensive. And if you look at doctors who are in general pretty aware of what the issues are, they're all taking these generic medicines. So we got to solve for the weight loss drugs, but that's going to rapidly evolve because there are dozens of effective weight loss drugs that are coming through the pipeline. So the competition's going to pick up. So we got this great body of knowledge and things that work, and we're not applying them. And I think one of the main missing links is the primary care system. We don't have one in the U.S. Everywhere I go, even professors in medical schools, their families can't get appointments. And the other consequence of that, and I'm very cognizant of, partly because I did have 7 years at Alphabet with Google and Verily, as you pointed out, that just leaves a wide open system for misinformation. So imagine if you think that a clinic doctor seeing a patient for 10 minutes in the clinic while staring at the keyboard and trying to get the billing correct is going to compete with 24/7 nutraceutical advertisements. It's not going to happen. You know, we're seeing that combination of factors lead to not the progress that we need. It's very fixable. We're spending $5 trillion a year on healthcare, as you know.
In that same vein of public health and misinformation also, we're in the middle of one of the worst measles outbreaks in modern history in multiple states. Again, if you were advising the government on how to respond, what would that response be? And then we'll talk a little bit more about misinformation.
Well, we need a full-throated endorsement of vaccination, which is one of the most, maybe the most important public health advance. I mean, you could argue about clean water and things that really also made a difference, but vaccination works. And of course, people do have side effects, and a small number, but an important number, have serious side effects. But if you look at the risk-benefit calculation, the benefits are so much greater than the risk, pretty much across the board. But there's also importance of separating into two tranches of vaccines, I believe. They're the vaccines that have to be employed in greater than 90 or 95% of people to prevent the disease altogether. And they're vaccines that are more personal. That is, you're protecting yourself and you're not affecting other people. But with measles, if you don't get vaccinated, you're putting other people at risk. And so I think those need a full-throated endorsement and public health programs to deliver the goods. What's happening is those programs are being cut back, and the information that's appearing on our government websites is not good, I would say.
We are coming to the close of our time, and I want to close with two very open-ended questions. The first is, what keeps you up at night right now?
Nothing keeps me up at night, because I was an intensive care unit doc for 35 years, and I learned to go to sleep whenever I can. And I'm good at that. And in terms of what worries me, you know, I'm the grandson of a Baptist minister. I sort of lived on the doing to others as you would have them do unto you, those sorts of views of Christianity. Not that, you know, and I think all religions have some version of that, but we seem to be going in the opposite direction of look out for yourself. Doesn't matter if you hurt other people in doing it. As long as you dominate and end up on top for you and your people. And I think that's a very dangerous direction for us to go in. So that plays out in health with the sort of self-centeredness of behavior as it relates to infectious diseases and guns. And in other ways, I mean, this thing that's going on with USAID, you know, the estimate is over 1 million people will die in Africa because we're not making the HIV drugs available. I don't know. I should probably not be sleeping at night because of that, but you do everything that you can. That's what you can do.
You've come out of a very intense job that probably was just 24/7, didn't get a lot of control of your own time. What are you excited about now? What are you going to focus on, and what really has you going?
Well, I'm 73 and I consider myself in the overtime of life right now. The game is completed, so every extra minute is a good minute. And I am playing golf almost every day, I will admit. I love the game for whatever reason. My grandfather played it, and then I got sort of, not that I'm any good at it, but exercise and being in the best condition I can be in to live a functional life is important. But I've been given an opportunity to unretire from Duke for the second time. I've retired twice. But much like the job I had at Alphabet or Google, they agreed with my request not to be responsible for any entity. I've done my share of building things and being in charge. I want to help other people. And I think the two big domains, this is probably not a surprise to you, are the information ecosystem. I'm increasingly fixated on, I think there are tricks to advertising that I saw in play at Google. I think it's the world's best at those tricks to get you to sort of supersede your cerebral cortex to go to the hippocampus and play to the emotional side. That's why advertisements have pictures and things. But the biggest thing is just repetition. And if you hear it over and over, you're likely to start believing it. And what's happened is if you're lying on the internet, there's no cost to just saying it over and over. If you're telling the truth, you got to do the work to make sure you're right and that you're up to date. That takes time. And right now, the good guys are being completely dominated by the not so good guys, I would say. That's just my opinion. But I think we need to develop reliable, repetitive sources of information that help people do things that are healthy and beneficial. That part of MAHA I like a lot. I mean, the fact that it's been brought front and center. I wish that the Biden administration had done that, but it just wasn't to be. And I think they were just fixated on COVID for obvious reasons. The second thing is the cardiometabolic stew, which I have expertise in, and I'm not, being a cardiologist, I'm not here to tell primary care people what to do, but I'm developing connections with people who are thinking differently about primary care, because I think everybody agrees there's no way you can take the current workforce and deliver what's needed. So it's got to be linked up with AI and digital technologies, but also with a very different looking workforce that gets paid differently, has more respect. Shouldn't just be the neurosurgeons that get respect or the cardiologists. This is a vital enterprise. So hopefully we'll make changes there. I'll tell you who really got fixated on this also was Atul Gawande, who, you know, has a wonderful ability to write. But, and, you know, most unfortunately, his whole enterprise at AID was taken out. So he's been very focused on that. But expect some really good writing from him on this. What Atul really convinced me of is that if you look at these countries like Costa Rica and Thailand that have one-tenth of net worth that we do and spend very little on healthcare, the big difference is they put primary care clinics in everybody's neighborhood. And that's been supported by AID to a large extent. So they're doing what we should be doing.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at those, there was a famous set of countries, including Sri Lanka and even Cuba in a time. And it really was, it was the combination of primary care and then some capacity around community health worker, people that could have a more high touch kind of relationship and availability of opportunities for activity and food, good, healthy food. Yeah. Well, listen, I just want to thank you for your service and for the service in all the roles you've had, but also now in a way that you can only do not being in the administration, trying to help hold our progress as a country. And somebody commented to me that my podcasts are very depressing right now. I think it's just that we're in this crucible, and we all hope that there's a world on the other side of that crucible that will be better. And all we can do is use our energies to try to make that happen. So I really appreciate that.
Couldn't agree more. And if it's depressing to people, so be it, because we owe it to people to tell the truth as we know it.
We've all heard the story of Humpty Dumpty that Rob references in this episode. You know, the confident egg who had a great fall and shatters into a million pieces. I think Rob's use of this analogy for the current state of the FDA is a good one, which begs the age-old question, how do we put Humpty Dumpty back together again? And is it even possible? As an American who has watched a loved one face a devastating illness, like so many of us have, I sure hope there's a fix. Because as Rob says, the very scientists and inventors and companies that are coming up with the next life-saving cure want more, not less, guidance and support from the FDA. So I want to repeat the two pieces of advice Rob has for Marty Makary, the new FDA commissioner. In the wake of massive firings, get to know the workforce you have left and engage with their work. Protect the sanctity of the line between politics and science. I sure hope he listens. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Rob Califf and his work. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.